Less and Better, Episode 8, A Compass, Not a Map. I'm Katie Revel.
I'm Olivia Oldham.
It seems like understanding less and better meets, what it could mean and what we think it should mean. It's even more complex than we'd realised when we first set out to make this series. As we've said again and again, working out what we think the right thing to do is, it depends fundamentally on what we decide to prioritise, what we think is important.
In this final episode, we're reflecting on everything we've heard over the past 7 episodes. We'll be thinking about what we, personally, have learned from everyone we've spoken to. We'll be sharing our unanswered questions, because, of course, we still have so many. And we'll be looking ahead, trying to describe our own visions of what a less and better future could look like.
No doubt, if we put everyone we've spoken to in a room together, there'd be plenty of disagreements. But what might they be able to agree on?
We do think there's some common ground, some pretty fundamental shared principles. Across our conversations, people agreed that any future of less and better meat should uplift ecological sustainability and respect the inherent value of non-human life. That it should recognise our entanglement and interdependence with each other and with other living things, that everyone should have a say in deciding what less and better meat might mean, and that it should prioritise justice and fairness for all. Could these principles be a starting point, a way to begin to move the conversation forward?
The aim would be that the food is produced in a way that is either, you know, maintaining our ecosystems or enabling them to flourish even more.
I think we need to humbly focus on studying natural cycles and how to harness them. If you produce something in a way that is damaging to the environment or to animals or to public health or to waterways or whatever, that should be factored into the price of what you produce.
What you're wanting to do is have a food system that does minimum harm and maximum good, both to the world we live in, the animals, plants that share it with us, and the people who consume and who produce.
One of the key things would be kindness when it comes to the way that we treat livestock, the way that we kind of view them. I don't believe that it's kind and compassionate.
I think care is so important, whether it's care for animals, care for people, places, plants, systems, processes, like just being intentional and mindful.
For me, it's about relationships, to just like really know where our food comes from, like the land and, you know, the people who are farming it.
The consumer being connected with the different stakeholders earlier on in the food chain, animals and humans. Yeah, everyone who's been involved up until that point to produce whatever the food product is at the end.
Just remembering that we're connected, I think, feels essential.
I guess it's that nature connectedness, recognising everything outside of our homes as kin.
Not viewing our natural resources as commodities and that recognising their value in itself.
Fundamentally, it would be about shifting food production from producing profits and money towards what we actually want, like what is it that we need to eat, what is a healthy, ecological, sustainable diet.
It's too much about numbers and quantities and pounds and finances. Everything stems from the soil, absolutely everything. All life is based on it, all life dies without it.
We need to radically shift our food system from the capitalist extractive form of food production that essentially still prevails, even though we know that that needs to change.
Really prioritising what we need to be producing in order to feed ourselves rather than, you know, what we can produce for a commercial return.
Different people have different constraints and may not be able to live up to what their ideal consumption is.
We're all consumers, so we all have a stake in this food system, and we're all kind of struggling to keep up with rising costs of food. There needs to be a universality of access to food based on nutrition and ecology, not based on how much money you've got.
Everybody should have access to food that is good for them and also grown or farmed in a way that is good for the environment. People shouldn't be forced to choose food that is worse for the environment because it's cheaper.
I think that a food system should be community owned and community led.
Rather than markets sort of dictating what should and shouldn't happen, we actually have like democratic processes that start to work out what our food system should look like based on current ecological realities.
It feels like these principles could help us navigate towards our own vision of what less and better meat could be. But we still have plenty of questions that we don't know the answers to.
One of the things I still feel most conflicted about is the question of killing animals. Can it really be right? Or maybe more specifically, is there really any meat available to me where the killing has been done in a way that is right?
And I suppose what that means to you for that to have been done in a way that's right. I mean, I think this is a point that I'm still struggling with as well. I wonder whether better is really the best that we can hope for in some ways. I don't know if I can fully square the idea that we've heard about of honouring an animal as a sentient being, as a being that has, who has thoughts and relationships, maybe even imagination. I don't know if I can ever square that idea with the idea of killing that animal so I can eat its flesh. But certainly for me, if I am going to continue eating meat, then I think I'd prefer to feel a bit uncomfortable. If I didn't feel at all uncomfortable, for me, that would suggest that I'm just not thinking about it enough. And maybe that makes me a hypocrite. I think it probably does in some ways. At this point, given everything we've heard, it does feel strange that I know really quite a lot about how the animals I eat, how they've spent their lives. But I really know nothing about how those lives ended, about how they were killed, where they were killed, what kind of a place it was, what the process was. So that's something I think I would like to know more about.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with you that the better part is particularly relevant here. But I also think that for me, it seems to be so tangled up with the less part of all of this, because from everything we've heard and everything we've learned, it seems difficult to imagine a good death, whatever that might be. But if such a thing exists, if you know, killing in a way that honors the life of the animal, in a way that is spiritually or deeply emotionally connected to the act of killing, you know, all of those things that might make up a good death, I don't see how they can be done at a large scale. I don't see how they can be done, you know, so frequently or so with the kind of disregard for those kinds of slow, conscious, attentive elements that seem to be required for a good death, because you can't have those elements when the scale gets too big. And so I really, more than any other aspect of the issue, I feel strongly that what might limit scale is this, is making sure that if we're taking the lives of animals, that it's done in a way that respects the animal.
And I think, in a way, the other side of that is the reality of it for the people involved. what is the impact on the people doing the work, on the people handling the animals, on the people carrying out that killing? Is it possible for someone to do that on an industrial scale and to be able to do it in a way that, you know, to the greatest extent possible, protects their health, physical health, mental health, emotional health? And so I think there's a direct relationship there between the experience of the animal and the experience of the person.
Another thing that I think I'll be thinking about a lot more is that question of, you know, what is this land good for and why do we think that? I think the binary that we talked about way back in episode 4 between sort of farmed and wild landscapes or land sparing and land sharing, I just still find that such a difficult conversation. I think about all of the places that I love most back home in New Zealand, and they're all beautiful areas of bush, not farmed landscapes. And I feel sad thinking that there used to be beautiful bush in the UK too, and there still are some fragments left. And it makes me sad that it feels so hard to even contemplate what it might look like in some places to bring that landscape, those ecosystems, the different social relations to nature that they might entail. It feels so hard to even think about what bringing that back might look like. Why can't we think about that beyond just it being financialized into carbon credits or nature-based solutions? Like, why couldn't these diverse landscapes be supported for what they are and for what they give us? And really the same question for beautiful multifunctional agroecosystems. Like, you know, why can we only imagine them existing and being viable and lasting in the landscape if they can turn a profit?
Something I still have questions about is the whole question of lab-based approaches to meat and to protein generally. My view has changed somewhat in the sense that I'm a lot less squeamish, I would say, about these technologies. I have less of that kind of knee-jerk ickiness that I maybe had before we started working on this series. And I think especially, for example, having spoken to Ilhtud, I can see better now how those kind of technologies might be able to fit into a less and better meat future. But I do still have some fundamental questions about them that are much less about the technology, actually, and much more about those bigger questions of power and control and transparency, the questions of who owns these technologies, who owns the patents, are they patented, who owns the facilities, who has access to the facilities, how much are we able to know about how they work, and yeah, is it feasible for them to exist at a scale where the people who are eating the products can actually understand how they were produced and have some sort of relationship with them, which I think is really important. And the overarching question in all of that for me is who ultimately is benefiting. And I think for me, that's really the same question that we need to apply to other approaches to production as well. And generally, to the question of how we use our limited resources, who's benefiting here?
Yeah, absolutely. This for me is like another really huge area of uncertainty that remains for me. Technologies like what we've heard about from Ilhtud, but also some of the other ones we haven't spoken about, the various forms of cultured meat, cultured protein. You know, can they be separated from existing social relations of extraction and exploitation? One, is that even possible? Or are they just too deeply entangled?
Yeah.
And if they can be separated, if it is possible to imagine these technologies existing in a totally different social, economic, political
context and in different relations, then what is their role in a future of food that's fair and sustainable and more generally oriented towards human and non-human flourishing? I think that they can have a role, but I think I need to answer for myself the question of whether they can be disentangled from existing power relations first before I can move on to thinking about how they might fit in a different set of relations.
Another really big question for me is the whole question of food justice. And I think at this point, I feel even more strongly than I did beforehand that we have to understand access to food, and that includes meat, as a right, not something that you have to earn. And I think that means decommodifying food. But obviously, that feels absolutely massive. I think there are kind of existing glimmers of people trying to do that within the constraints of the existing system, and we've spoken to a lot of them in this series. But as we've discussed, we're so constrained by our current political, economic, and cultural reality as well. So that's a big unanswered question for me, is how do we get there? Elise Vach, she was talking about past land relations, and she made the point that, you know, land used to be organized to make sure that everyone had enough to eat. It seems like such a no-brainer, but we're so far away from that. So yeah, I think a big question that comes out of that for me is, if we think less and better is the way to go, how can we pursue that without just entrenching existing inequalities and amplifying the existing situation where good meat or better meat, however we define that, you know, for me, that would be meat that embodies the values that we've talked about. So things like environmental integrity, respect for the animals and the people involved. How can we do that without making it so expensive that it's just inaccessible to everyone but a very privileged few people? And I don't know what the answer is to that question.
Well, I think it comes back to something that we spoke about back at the beginning of the series and in episode 2 about the difficulty that we feel around the urgency of acting on climate crisis, on the biodiversity crisis, that on the one hand, absolutely, it's deeply urgent, but on the other hand, if we want to build a better world, we also have to take the time to think about these deeper questions of values and social relations and all the different things that we've spoken about throughout this series of you know, what lies beneath the surface. And so I think there's a risk that less and better as an idea, as a vision, that gets reduced to just a question of urgent action on environmental destruction. And I think it is that question, but I think from my perspective, if we allow less and better to become so one-dimensional, then it risks doing all of those things that you've described. And so I think that it's really important to me to maintain the focus on justice and fairness so that less and better can be a meaningful starting point for a vision of a better food future.
Even though there's still a lot we're unsure about, making this series has helped both of us, in different ways, to build a clearer vision of what less and better meat means to us. So what might the future look like? I know that some of the people we've spoken to aren't necessarily on board with the less part of it. Personally, I do think less meat is necessary, certainly if we're understanding that on a national scale or a global scale. If we apply the values that we've talked about, I don't think
industrialized animal agriculture can be justified. That's the conclusion I've come to. I don't think it can be justified on environmental grounds, on animal welfare grounds, worker welfare grounds, health grounds, ethical grounds. And if that is the case, then I think what has to follow from that is that we have to eat less meat. But I think a really important point for me there is that less has to mean rebalancing. So in this less and better meat future, I think there probably could and there probably should be some people, if they want to, there should be some people eating more meat than they do at the moment. And there should be some people eating a lot less. I think it's really tricky if less and better is framed only as an imperative for consumers, for eaters, because if you're already in a position where you're just struggling to afford food, you're certainly not going to be able to afford better food. And the idea of cutting down, the idea of eating less, is not going to make sense. So I think in my vision of less and better, it would require us to reframe it so it's really clear that the burden of responsibility to make better individual choices, that isn't equally shared between all members of society. I think it means that those of us who are in a position to choose to eat less and better, that we are encouraged and we're empowered and maybe we're pressured as well to make that choice. But crucially, that doesn't become a reason to judge those people who aren't able to make that choice. I think the better part of less and better is really tricky, but I do think focusing on values, as we've tried to do, I do think that might be really helpful. There was an analogy you mentioned, I think way back in episode one, about a compass. So rather than trying to draw a map to show us the way, it's about building a compass that can guide us. At least having some means of finding a sense of direction in our thoughts and in our actions. And again, to come back to one of the questions I had about who's benefiting here, I think in all of this, it's so, so important to keep asking whose interests is this serving? And I think that question should be applied to any proposed solution. And again, it's about getting beyond that surface level. It's about getting beyond the specifics of a technology or approach to the underlying economic logic. And I think there's a lot of dishonesty and a lot of cynicism in the marketing both of meat and of so-called meat alternatives. A lot of these alternative products are produced by exactly the same companies that also produce industrial meat products. So there's really not anything radical or anything truly alternative about them. So yeah, I think as part of that compass, or maybe our, to extend the metaphor, maybe our, you know, North Star has to be whose interests is this serving? I think that's something that is core, certainly, to my vision of how we might work towards less and better. I think I also really want to highlight how much respect I have for the people that we've spoken to for this series. Whatever their view and whatever their approach to their work, I don't think cynical is a word that would apply to any of them. I think the producers that we've spoken to, the ones that are producing meat and the ones who aren't, my impression certainly is that they're all driven first and foremost by values other than profit. And it's really, really frustrating. It's infuriating that it's not easier for them to make a living doing what they do and that they're not celebrated and supported more. I think in my vision of less and better, they would be celebrated. They would be recognized and supported more.
Yeah, I think you have a much more maybe coherent vision of what a less and better meat future might look like. In every episode, I think what I come out of it thinking is that I am resoundingly in favor of needing to eat less meat for all those reasons you mentioned. And of course, that takes into account all of the caveats that you mentioned, and some people already do eat very little or none. But I think we need to be eating much less meat, and instead our diets would rely much more heavily on pulses and legumes and all the wonderful plants that Pete Ioneta told us about. In my vision of a less and better meat future, I would most love to see the food system transformed so that it's no longer based around commodities. And that's not necessarily a comment about scale. I think we can have lots of different scales of production depending on what's needed and what our values require. But I don't think it's right for people only to access good meat, good food, if they can afford it. I don't think it's right for farmers to only be able to produce in ways that are good for the planet and for their own well-being and for the well-being of the animals if they can make enough money out of it. I don't think it's right that land is almost always a speculative private asset, that it's used and abused in the name of enriching its owner. So my vision really is for a future where food and meat or non-meat proteins is treated like something that, as human beings who are alive, we are entitled to continue living and to live a good life and a dignified life and a healthy life and a happy life. My vision is of a future where we've moved beyond the idea that land is a private commodity, that its purpose is to benefit and enrich its singular owner. And I really truly believe that both less and better can flow from there.
What's your vision?
I can see a future where maybe most people are eating plant-based meat alternatives on a day-to-day basis or lab-grown meat, but then there are cheeses or like milks and then meat as well that come from small holdings. The animals are extremely well looked after and they're sustainable and it is a luxury product.
People would have more of an understanding where their food came from, because I think with that type of understanding, you appreciate that it's finite and you appreciate how much energy and effort goes into every single bit of food that you consume. And I think you would end up being more mindful in your consumption as a result, and people wouldn't eat meat at all.
The way I would love our food system to look would be to have the United Kingdom as an area where we're growing large amounts of plants on relatively small areas, that we wouldn't have livestock and that we'd be leaving our kind of upland and marginal areas for biodiversity. We'd have, you know, reintroduction of a lot of the species that we've lost, and that we would really be concentrating food for us on a small area and then trying to let nature take its course.
I would actually get rid of all deforestation to produce pasture and try to roll back pasture in places where it could revert to peatland or forest. And then with whatever remaining pasture, we just have happy cows and happy chickens regeneratively produced.
Our statement of purpose is to facilitate abundance and diversity to nourish our community. And so the values there are diversity, abundance, nourishment, and community. If we could have a food system that ticks off those four, that would be great. That would be a good starting place.
It should be transparent in livestock farming and growing vegetables from start to finish. A person could go to a supermarket and buy a slab of meat. They're not even thinking how that whole process went through. They're eating that. But when you talk to them about it, how they're reared, how they go for slaughter, how they're killed, if general public can understand that and see that, then they can make a decision whether to eat plant-based diet or still sit and eat meat.
I think we live in like a deeply like death phobic culture. We're afraid of death, we push it away, and I think that's very true in our food system as well. I think to like enhance the like awareness and understanding of like how food is grown, how animals are like, you know, tended, what it means to care for animals and then, you know, kill them for meat, having proximity to these life and death processes that are so part of life that really, I think, transform the ways that we relate to food and farming, but also just to each other and our communities and the lives that we lead.
I think it's just important to acknowledge that we're so far away from the food systems that we need that it will take some time to transition, and that can't be an overnight transition. How you get there is another question. But things like, you know, having more equitable access to land, you know, more skill development in ecological land management and ecological food production.
I would like to see more community growing in urban areas. That would just increase awareness of pulses and legumes. Community kitchens, where people can reinvigorate food culture, because food culture is being eroded. I'm also given a lot of hope by farmers that are starting with, you know, short value chains, connecting with consumers. It's a bottom-up approach, if you like, to the problem. We've been waiting for the top-down fix for quite a while, so let's try the bottom-up, please. I don't think there's one quick fix. I think a multifunctional approach is needed, and throwing everything at it from all angles.
We need to have a system that looks at land beyond ownership, beyond private property. Like, we need to really imagine a way in which people who want to be living in relationship with land can do that, and that land isn't some kind of tax haven. It's all of our collective birthright. Anyone who lives at all deserves to have a deep relationship with land.
A food system that values the natural resources that are fundamental to how we produce food, be it soil, be it water, but also human labor, the welfare of the farmers that produce this food, but then recognizing that valuing all of these things at whatever the market price might be might make food inaccessible to a lot of consumers. I think if we've learned anything in the last 50, 60 years is that just producing more food is not solving issues of food security, and that it's a distribution problem. That being said, solving the problem of access to healthy, nutritious food is also the problem of solving global inequality and poverty. But I think specifically for the food system, if we think of food as a social good that everyone should have access to, then I think the answer is also that producing a lot of cheap food that is not nutritious is not solving anyone's problem, either on the producer end or the consumer end. And so I think, like, a food system that is built on the principles of food sovereignty is the only answer in ensuring justice at both ends of the spectrum.
Passover is this time when we are remembering the Exodus and, like, liberation from slavery in Egypt. You know, the leaders of that revolution, of that liberation movement, were shepherds, you know, and we were asking, why would people who were close to animals and close to the land be the ones to, like, lead people in revolution? It feels like an important memory to muster. This is in all of our ancestral memories, like, this is what is possible through farming, like, stirring the possibilities of liberatory struggle and deep connection. There's so many incredible farmers and land workers who are doing that already, and I think, you know, more and more of us can get there. We have the food system of our dreams. It just needs to be allowed to flourish.
Thanks for listening. You can find a transcript of this episode and links to relevant resources on the Farmarama website.
If you value what we do at Farmarama, please consider supporting us on Patreon.
Less and Better is researched, produced, and edited by me, Katie Revel.
And me, Olivia Oldham.
With the support of executive producer Joe Barrett.
In this episode, we heard the voices of Chris, Elise, Andrew, Molly, Nikki, Sarah,
Hibba, Samson, James, Alex, Colin, Dora, Edwin, Raymond, TJ, Ellie, Kumar, Pete, and Divya.
Our series music is by Alex Batchelor.
And our artwork is by Jagoda Sadowska.
Thanks to the rest of the Farmarama team, Dora Taylor, Annie Landless, Eliza Jenkins, and Lucy Fisher.
Less and Better was made possible thanks to generous funding from the Roddick Foundation and the A-Team Foundation.